This is Jazz Talk, presented by Melbourne International Jazz Festival. We would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land and pay respects to their elders past, present and future, as well to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in the wider Melbourne community and beyond. We are honoured to contribute to over 60,000 years of music making, knowledge sharing and storytelling that has taken place on this land. Hi, my name's Chelsea Wilson. I'm the Artistic Associate of Melbourne International Jazz Festival Congress. This conversation, called Chart a Course, was captured at Melbourne Recital Centre during Congress 2021. In this highly informative panel, industry experts discuss artists and composer rights, intellectual property, and the relationship between independent artists and major collection societies. We also talk about artist income streams, negotiating fees for live shows, and so much more. Featuring Paul Davies, Director of Musicians from Musicians Australia, Maria Amato, CFO and CEO of the Australian Independent Record Label Association, Cameron Lamb, Art Music Lead at the Australasian Performing Right Association, and Lynn Small, COO for both the Australian Recording Industry Association and the Phonographic Performance Company of Australia. This panel is essential listening for all artists from emerging to established. This is Chart a Course. I'd like all of you, if you can, to please describe for us what you do, what your organisation does, in one sentence. should we start with you, Lynn?
Thank you, Chelsea. Great to be here this morning, and I'd just like to acknowledge that I'm speaking to everyone from Gadigal land here in Sydney, and pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging. I'm the COO of PPCA, the Phonographic Performance Company of Australia. I also work for ARIA, if anyone has questions about ARIA later on. But PPCA is essentially a not-for-profit copyright collecting society that manages rights in sound recordings as distinct from musical works, issuing licences for broadcast, public performance, communication, and paying through the net distributable surplus every year to our registered artists and rights owners. A long sentence, but I think I got it in.
That's great. Thank you. Maria.
I'm Maria Amato. I'm the CEO of AIR, which is the Australian Independent Record Labels Association. We're a member-based organisation and we're also a not-for-profit, and we strive to promote and celebrate the success of artists and labels who are strive to carve out a career on their own terms and remain independent. We have an annual AIR Awards that we put on every year to celebrate success, as Chelsea would know, and we also hold an annual conference. We're also running the Australian Women in Music Mentor Program, which you may or may not have heard of, but head to our website, all the details are there, and we provide professional development and mentorship for anyone who identifies as a woman or non-binary, to help them progress their career in this industry. And we also put on weekly charts and newsletters. Thank you.
Nice. Hi, I'm Cameron Lamb. I'm the Art Music Lead at APRA AMCOS. APRA AMCOS is a member-based organisation based in Australia and New Zealand, and we're responsible for licensing businesses within this territory to use music and to basically turn those licences into royalties for the composers and writers who've created that music.
Paul?
Hi, well, thanks for this. And I want to acknowledge that I'm on the land of the Gadigal people as well, and acknowledge their elders and all First Nations elders and emerging leaders across all of this nation. Musicians Australia, we're a trade union. We're part of the Media, Entertainment and Arts Alliance, and we were formed late 2018. And what we do is, as an organisation of and for musicians, led by musicians, for the benefit of musicians, we aim to fix all forms of industry problems, including problems with, if I can put it bluntly, exploitation. So we're here to represent musicians as musicians within the industry to achieve a better deal.
Thanks so much, Paul. So I guess that's really one of our focuses in this panel, is really that all of the people sitting on this stage have an interest in supporting artists and the people that support artists to do what they do, and to let you know what you're entitled to in terms of what revenue you can access and what support is available to you, because it is a really large industry, and especially as a self-managed artist or someone with a small team, you know, there's a lot of things that you need to do, but there are people who can help, which is brilliant. So just to talk about some of those possible revenue streams, maybe we'll start with Cameron. Can you tell us what are some of those opportunities for musicians to earn revenue? What are they entitled to? And can you also point out maybe around distribution timelines?
Yeah, sure. So with APRA MCOS, we're dealing with composers and arrangers, people who are creating like the compositional blueprint of the work per se. And so basically whenever that work is utilised by a business globally, you're entitled to a royalty. So that could look like radio play, that could look like a gig in this very venue, this could be online streaming. All of these things are licensed by APRA MCOS, and basically our job is to take the licence fees, logs of data of basically what's been used, and we get that from a few different sources, do what we technically call a horrific amount of math, and pay it out to you, the songwriter, a composer or arranger. In terms of timeline, I normally say about 6 months after usage. It takes generally about 3 months for us to get all the information, to process it and pass it out to you quarterly. But we've just launched an app very recently, the APRA MCOS for Music Creators app, which allows you to see what royalties you've received and from where, and kind of get a bit of a breakdown and get really into the nitty-gritty of that as well, so you actually have access to that information for you and your business and your practice.
Yeah, great. Lynn, are you able to talk us through, in terms of PPCA, the process for artists who are releasing their own music and any copyright or royalties that they might be entitled to there?
Of course. Thanks, Chelsea. There are two ways, I suppose, that an artist might have a relationship with PPCA. First of all, PPCA has long had a policy which we call the Direct Artist Distribution Policy, and that is available to featured artists on Australian recordings, so you need to be an Australian citizen. But you can register with PPCA regardless of whether you are an owner of the master recording. Under this scheme, even though you have no legal right to a payment, you can register with PPCA to receive, you know, 50% of the funds earned by PPCA in respect of the relevant tracks. So many artists are registered with PPCA under that system. And I would really recommend everyone considers it, because you're getting the payment directly from us, regardless of your recoupment situation with any label that you might be signed to, and it certainly cuts out the delay of us paying a label and being paid further down the track from that. So that's one way an artist might have a relationship with PPCA and receive payments. The second, and perhaps becoming increasingly common, is that artists are very often, in fact, the owners of the master recordings. People are creating their own recordings, retaining ownership, managing, you know, their own careers. They would then connect with PPCA as what we call a PPCA licensor. Excuse me. And that's the way that PPCA can actually issue blanket licenses. It's by rights owners coming to us, signing our standard input agreement, which allows us to include your repertoire in the blanket licenses that we sell to broadcasters and public performance venues and people running, for example, some online streaming services. So two ways. If you own recordings, the master rights, please contact us. And if you're an Australian featured artist on a recording, not a session musician, please also contact us, because you may be eligible under the Direct Artist Scheme.
Yeah, so that's a real 101, is that if you are a songwriter or a composer, you need to be a member of APRA AMCOS so you can receive royalties for when your compositions are played by yourself or by other people or on radio or used in any purpose. But if you also own your own sound recordings, then you need to be a member of PPCA because a recording has a different royalty attached. So when you have your music played on radio, you should be getting two royalties, essentially, if you're the owner of the recording. One royalty because your recording that you own was used, and a royalty because your song was used. So please make sure that you join both organisations. Maria, in terms of AIR, if you're an artist that starts their own label to release their music, how can they get involved with AIR?
Well, I'd suggest coming along to IndieCon next year, signing up to our newsletter, which is free, and you can see who all our friends of AIR are. People like Ditto, that I think Sarah is going to be speaking at this conference a bit later. And you'll be part of the network of artists and labels who explore challenges that are affecting the industry, how to run their businesses better, because we all believe that if you're a musician, you're an entrepreneur. You're doing what you love and you're trying to monetize that and create a financial future for yourself. So being part of organizations like APRA AMCOS and PPCA and AIR can only help you on your journey, because you need to arm yourself with as much information that you can. Some of the friends of AIR offer discounts and offers to AIR members along the way. We also have a collective bargaining arrangement with MTV for members. 10 years ago, songs that were played on MTV weren't captured by the normal avenues of collection. So as members, if your music is played on MTV, we collect money and we distribute to people once a year who are AIR members. And there are lots of workshops. We did one as part of Melbourne International Games Week last month in October. Well, we're in December already. Offering as many educational opportunities as we can. We're not core-funded by government, so all our partnerships that we engage with are mainly commercial of nature, so that we try and get money to deliver conferences and projects for the benefit of our members.
Yeah, it's really exciting. So, you know, it's brilliant if you can partner with an existing label, but sometimes there might not be a label that feels like the right fit for you. So you can start your own label, and by being part of AIR, you can connect with other like-minded people who own their own labels and explore those kinds of opportunities there. I'm going to go back to Cam for this next question. Somebody asked me this recently for songwriters and composers in the room who might be collaborating with other artists. The great thing is, as artists, we're able to nominate with APRA when we register a song how we're dividing that royalty. So if you've co-written with someone else, I'm this percentage of the song, you're this percentage of the song. How do you recommend going about having those conversations in terms of determining the band split?
Totally. And all these conversations, and so many of these conversations, are so much better to have at the beginning of the process, especially before there's money attached. It's so much easier to kind of have a really good, honest conversation and not feel like you're missing out about something when everything already, you know, has a dollar value attached to it. So many of the issues with registrations and disputes kind of come because someone hasn't had a conversation early on in the piece, has made a bunch of assumptions, and now everyone's angry. So basically, once the work is complete, and I mean the work from a compositional perspective, once you kind of know what all the moving parts are, how it's going to work, that's a really good time to sit down and have a chat. I know a bunch of people go with the Nashville rule of, like, if you're in the room writing, everyone splits it equally. I know some people who do like a 50-50 split around music and lyrics. I know other people who have kind of designated splits that they've kind of come to through their own practice. I find one of the things, one of the places this often comes up as well, and something I really wanted to touch on, because I think sometimes we miss it, is around improvised work and things that are kind of composed in real time. And so part of that is kind of being able and willing to have that conversation ahead of time. I actually think before you start, making things together, going, oh, okay, cool. I reckon we're just going to do an equal split of this, or we're going to do these splits. and then being able to have a refining conversation after the fact. Like, it's always really, really good to be able to kind of touch base with everyone, make sure everyone's happy, because that's kind of our criterion at APRO, is that, like, we actually don't mind what your splits are. They can be anything, as long as everyone agrees. As soon as someone doesn't agree, then we'll put it on hold, wait for you guys to kind of have a conversation, figure out how it's going to go, and then royalties will start flowing again. But, yeah, talk early, keep talking, and get all of these conversations in writing as well. Like, an email chain is so nice, just so everyone has something to kind of come back to at the end and, like, go, oh, what did I say 5 years ago? Oh, that was what we agreed on. Okay, cool.
I'd also recommend getting a legal agreement.
Yes, legal agreement. But these conversations can be really complex and challenging because it's also a very emotional thing, and you have to really dig deep, I think, and be prepared to be vulnerable when you're co-writing with other people. So you've just shared this moment where you've bared your soul on these lyrics, or you've really shown some ideas, and you know, you've got to be open to criticism where someone says, oh, I don't think that really works, and let's try this other thing. And so then to turn the conversation on to money and how all of that emotional work and creativity can be summed up in a percentage point feels pretty cold, and it can be hard. Paul, do you have any suggestions on how you can navigate those conversations and keep the harmony and trust within your band?
Well, that's a very difficult question. It's not, and I mean, I'm not a psychologist. What we're here to, what Musicians Australia is about, I suppose, to, if you really were to boil it down, is about ensuring that musicians are able to control their product and have full ownership. And of course, if you're working collaboratively, as we often do, that means you need to be able to be honest about what you're doing with one another in a kind of creative sense, but also, I think, in a legal sense and in a sense that's based on values and ethics. I mean, it's often the case, isn't it, that the relationships, the legal relationships between musicians are not clear, as I think was indicated earlier. And it's possible that many of those relationships are ones that are dealt with in the law. I mean, it's possible that musicians work with one another as employees, but are not treated as employees often, right? So if you were to examine the relationship, it might turn out to be one of an employment relationship, which requires a really standard sort of and well-defined remuneration according to the award. It's possible that it's not a relationship of employment and that it's a relationship more of a partnership. But so, look, this huge question, which I'd love to riff on for a while, pardon the pun, but I think there are some of the essential points. Our main concern is that whoever you are, and that is whatever your relationships are with other musicians, that as a musician and as a group of musicians, you need to be able to be confident in demanding your cut, your share of whatever income is generated through your work. I mean, musicians are the original gig economy workers, of course. Very topical phrase these days. And we shouldn't ignore the fact that many of them, most in fact, get work which isn't well rewarded. The incomes that musicians receive generally are well below the average income for the workforce generally, and therefore we've got a big problem to address. That's what we're about. But I've digressed from your question.
That's okay. I think what we're really touching on here is valuing our own worth and valuing our own contribution to the music. And there's so many negotiations that we have to engage in when we are part of an industry that is unregulated. We have to negotiate for what our performance fees are. We negotiate for, you know, project, you know, if you're getting commissioned to write some arrangements, that's all negotiated. So songs and compositions are really one of the first steps in negotiations that we have to go through. So being able to feel comfortable having those conversations and represent yourself with your other composers and your musician friends, you know, is great, because it's also, you know, just the starting point of all those other negotiations you're going to have. And I think it's really worth considering, because it can have future repercussions on your relationships, and relationships really is the key word here. So I know some bands, for example, and I think even Powderfinger were like this, they decided to split all the songwriting royalties equal between all band members, and they did that for their entire career, and it meant that they were a very kind of happy, harmonious band, because they all felt like they were equally invested in the project and they got equal returns. So regardless of who wrote the song, it was all split between them, and they stayed together for over 20 years, which is great. I have another example of a friend of mine who wrote an entire EP worth of music herself, then engaged three session musicians to play on the record with her. They were all friends of hers, or she felt like they were friends, and so she decided to split the songwriting royalty with all of them, even though they didn't actually write the song. It was about keeping them on board. Then those relationships didn't last. She started working with other people, and a few years later, one of those tracks was used for a banking commercial, and around $40,000 fee. So then she had to give each of those band members the $10,000 apiece. So, you know, that's the kind of financial repercussion, is maybe you're nice in that negotiation and you thought, oh, I'm being very generous, and that's really great. But you have to sort of also think, well, if this song took off, then what happened? Will things get nasty in the future? Particularly bringing it back to a kind of jazz context, a lot of musicians who perform improvised music or jazz love to revisit compositions by other people, and performing and recording standards is kind of a bit of a jazz tradition. I'm wondering if Lynn and Cam in particular, if you could talk about the process around getting the rights to record someone else's song and what that entails.
Sure, I might start if that's all right. So I guess one of the first things to note with a lot of jazz standards is that they're not in public domain. And so what I mean by that, basically, once the copyright on a work expires, it enters the public domain, the idea being it now belongs to humanity, right? A lot of works that we consider jazz standards still fall under copyright, which lasts basically until 70 years after the final author's death. And so what that means is that for a lot of those works, you will need to seek clearance, especially if you're doing things like arrangements or covering those works. There are blanket licenses in place. So one of the main ones that we do at APRA AMCOS is the audio manufacturer license, which is going to cover you to do pressings of your version of these jazz standards, and their equivalent things for digital as well.
Lynn, recording and releasing a cover?
Yeah, look, I think provided you've got your use of the work sorted, which Cam has just described, as long as you've got the arrangements in place, you know, with APRA AMCOS or whoever to be able to use that particular work, you can create your own recordings, and that's not a problem. And I'd always encourage people, obviously, to register them with PPCA. But I'd just like to take the opportunity, if you don't mind, Chelsea, to just go back a bit on some of the comments that, you know, very good points that you and Cam made about getting your arrangements in place. It's important that you consider that and consider it separately, not just for the writing, but also for the recording. If you then go on to produce a recording together, it's very important to know exactly what the arrangements are. Are you there as a session musician? I mean, Paul mentioned the potential that you may be there as an employee. If you don't have that sorted, you may all be joint owners of the recording, and that might be terrific, but you need to all understand that. The problem might not just be about arguing in the future about who gets how much. It might be about someone approaching you wanting to use it, and you cannot get everyone's agreement. If you are offered a wonderful advertisement opportunity in 5 years' time, splitting it with other people might be the least of your worries if other people can simply say no and you miss the opportunities. So I can't reiterate often enough how important it is to understand from the outset and to document, even if simply, you know, what the shares are in terms of earnings, but also separately, who actually owns the reporting and can make decisions about how and when it's used.
So how do we work out who owns the recording? Is that old adage, you know, he who pays for the recording owns the recording? Is that still the main thing?
I mean, personally, I would not rely on that. I would always recommend that people going into a recording situation have a discussion and make agreements. It may be that you're hiring someone to come in and genuinely do a session musician arrangement with you to contribute to the recording. I would make sure that was documented and that was the arrangement and that they are in fact assigning the rights in the recording to whoever's paying for it. I personally wouldn't want to rely on just the assumption that because it was my studio or I paid the studio bill, I own it. I think that is a risky way to proceed.
Yeah, I might add to that as well. Like, the last thing you ever want to do is be like relying on the defaults of the law. It's really vague. Everyone's got a very different understanding. It is so much easier to have a clear conversation ahead of time. Be willing to have a conversation after if you think anything needs to be adjusted. I think that's really valid and important. But to have a well-documented conversation that's in writing and a legal contract as well, especially when you're talking about ownership. Like, that's what we're discussing here. As Chelsea pointed out, this isn't just like, okay, who gets paid for the next little while? It's like, who has veto rights on the use of this recording or this composition? Like, as I just mentioned, like the copyright in this work lasts for your entire life plus 70 years. Like, you know, this is an important conversation to have so that everyone's clear. The last thing you want is for you know, people to not be sure where they stand or feel uncomfortable. It's going to affect not only this work, but also your relationship with them, you know, in the future.
Yeah, it is tricky, especially if you've received some funding to make a record. A lot of bands that I work with, they're not established as companies. There's usually one person in the band who has an ABN, they're a sole trader, they've applied for funding on behalf of the band, so technically they're the ones who are paying for the record and then project managing it. So then you go, but who? So whose record is it anyway? It's really a tricky conversation.
I'd suggest that if you are in a band, that each musician has its own ABN and then it becomes a partnership of ABNs. And the person that's doing all the organising, you know, they might say, well, if it was me and I was in a band with you and I'm doing all the admin and the bookkeeping, I'd argue that I deserve a little bit more. I mean, and that you should have the confidence to have that conversation, because it is a lot of headache to do the acquittal, to apply for the funds, to bank it, to distribute payments to members. But that's something that perhaps if you see someone you trust, to have that conversation, or talk to someone at APRA or PPCA or even at AIR, or go and see a lawyer about that kind of thing, and just make sure that you are paying above award, because that is very important, and that's what people at Musicians Union are trying to lobby for. We don't want to exploit anyone.
Yeah, absolutely. Lynn, I'd also like to chat to you in terms of your role with ARIA as the COO and just talk about the charts and how labels and artists and, you know, independent labels can put themselves in the best position to kind of appear in those charts. Oh, have we lost Lynn? That's okay. Hopefully we'll find her and she'll come back. That happens, the new digital world. So we're going to talk now about live gigs and the streaming live hybrid. So we've done live shows, we did digital stream gigs, now there's some gigs that are a mix of both. So Cam, what happens in that regard with royalties? If I'm doing a show for a live audience that's also being streamed, do I get two royalties for that?
Sure. So I guess the important thing to note with royalties is that it isn't like magical money that just appears. All royalties come from a license. I know, right? One day we will find the magic royalty tree and it'll be wonderful. But until that point, basically, every time you receive royalty for your work, it's come from a business paying a license. So what that means is, in the case of, say, like a live stream only, so say that it's a live stream that's been done on, say, YouTube or Facebook or Instagram, for example, or TikTok, all of that is covered by the services license. So there's a portion of all of those businesses' license within Australia and New Zealand to cover that usage, and so those can be claimed. Likewise, with a live gig, you know, your venue will pay an annual license, or the festival that you're performing at will pay an event license to cover the usage of music as a part of that. And so likewise, you'd receive a royalty there as well. What we often see now as we're kind of moving into this hybrid arrangement, as we're starting to return to our, you know, our venues and our concert halls, is a joint license where the event producer or the venue will kind of take out a license that covers both components. And so you will see royalties coming through. They'll generally need to be claimed via the same method. So often for those like specific events or like festival style things, you might get asked for a set list at the gig. That's great. That means the licensee is covering all of the data and you don't need to worry about it. Or likewise, you put in a performance report or a live streaming performance report to cover those usages via your APRA membership. So in short, yes, assuming there are licenses.
Okay, great. Thanks, Gam. We've lost our Zoom participants, but that's okay. I hope they're going all right. Technology, just gotta love it. So Cameron, can you also talk to us about playing at festivals and live venues in terms of the royalties and paperwork?
Yeah, totally. So as an APRA member, you have a couple of responsibilities. We like to keep the admin to a minimum because, let's be honest, none of us particularly enjoy extra paperwork. The two big things you kind of got to do is like tell us when you've written new stuff so we know it's yours. And then the other thing that we ask you to do is to tell us when you performed live or when your music has been performed live. The reason for that is that we've got all of these venues that pay an annual fee, and that annual fee is for a blanket license. It allows them to play whatever they want. It's the easiest way to get a venue to agree to a license, that it makes the paperwork easier on their end as well. So what we ask is for you, as the person who's written the music, is to give us the information so we can distribute and we can give you your cut of those license fees. Where that can be a little bit different, though, is where you've got a festival. So a festival, it's a much more condensed thing. It might be over multiple venues. And so what normally happens is there is a specific license just for that festival, and that would be distributed directly. It's what we call a distributable event. There, the licensee actually takes care of the data, as I was mentioning. Like, they'll collect set lists from everyone, they'll send it through to us, and we'll chase them for information. So that actually gets paid through automatically. You don't need to worry about that one. So it's just when you're doing gigs off your own bat, or you're doing them in like standard venues and stuff, that we'd like you to, again, you can pop it in via the app, we can log into the website. It's really simple. It's literally, when did you play? Where did you play? What did you play? Submit.
And on that, I know that Lynn's not here, but as a licensor, you've got until the 31st of August to submit your reports so that you can get paid. And your dates are?
We actually don't have dates anymore, which is super exciting. So traditionally for performance reports, we had an annual system to match the annual license. After many, many, many years, we've finally moved that to a quarterly system. So you can report whenever you want throughout the year, and you'll get paid throughout the year as well, which we're really, really excited by. So, and it also means you can go through and backdate stuff as well. You can claim up to the last 3 financial years. So definitely get in touch if you need to do that, and have some time over Christmas for extra paperwork, because we all love extra paperwork, right, Chelsea?
Yeah, absolutely love it. Totally love it. So most artists or composers will have that first contact with APRA AMCOS registering some songs, but it's our APRA writers, songwriters. It's a membership organisation.
It is.
So how else can you get involved with APRA, and how might your relationship change with APRA throughout your career?
Yeah, totally. So you should join with APRA as soon as you've contributed to your first composition. So that's writing your first song, that's collaborating with someone, that's improvising a work with someone. Basically, as soon as your work is available to the public in some way, shape or form, you can earn royalties from it, and you're eligible to join as an APRA member. So it's super easy via our website. We've streamlined the application form, so it's like 10, 15 minutes max, which is amazing. And obviously over time it's going to change, but like what we would like to see is like basically small little check-ins for admin. So like, hey, I've written a new album. Great, let me quickly jump in, register those with APRA so that they know, so they can keep forwarding me money. Oh, hey, I've just got paid by APRA. I want to see what that's for. Oh, I can jump in and see a breakdown from, you know, what works have I been paid for like, oh, is this from radio? Is this from live gigs? Or is this from Australia? Or is this from the US? Or, oh, hey, I got this royalty from Austria for live streaming. That's interesting. Let's find out what happened there. Obviously, as you go through your career, there's lots of other touch points for us as well. So we've got things like the Art Music Awards, which, you know, really celebrate like classical, jazz, improvised, experimental music and sound art. We've got the Art Music Fund, which is a commissioning grant. We've got lots of little events as well about connecting members. So we've got like Meet the Locals, which we've run down here, both in particular genres, but also just kind of more broadly of, I actually always think there's a lot of really exciting things you can learn from people outside of your specific genre. All the way through to, you know, running for board or, you know, jumping into like development sessions or partnering with us to kind of run industry-focused events. So there's a lot of touch points over the course of your career.
And during the pandemic, there were some really brilliant initiatives from APRA AMCOS, such as the songwriting collaborations, which happened digitally and those kind of things, which is great. Mm. So, yeah, that was really good to see. Lynn, it's great to have you back. Welcome back. Just before we lost you, we were about to have a chat about the charts and the arias and how artists can position themselves when they're independent to see themselves on those charts.
Yeah, no, happy to, Chelsea. Thank you. Look, there are a number of charts produced in Australia. There are the charts that I hope people are familiar with that ARIA produces each week. And there are also the charts that AIR puts out that Maria could speak to, obviously, in more detail. I don't know that people are aware that ARIA actually provides the data to AIR to allow it to produce its charts as well.
Yes.
I think it's also worth making sure that people realise that you don't have to be an ARIA member for your material to appear on the ARIA charts. So I would really encourage people, when they're putting out a release, to consider making sure ARIA knows about the release, and if they are interested in it being in the, you know, ARIA's genre charts, you know, one of which covers jazz, that they make sure we have the information and they have flagged it for the jazz chart. Even if you think that you mightn't have sufficient activity to have success on the ARIA chart, bear in mind that data also goes to AIR. There is an opportunity that you could appear on the AIR chart. So it's at no cost. There's information on the ARIA website. I'm happy to shoot that through to people afterwards if it would be helpful. But particularly the genre charts, if you're releasing jazz recordings, I really encourage you to put them forward for the relevant ARIA charts as well.
Yeah. And there's a short little video on the AIR website about how to get your music in the ARIA charts, and that might be something that you might want to consider having a quick look at. You don't have to be a member to see that. And as Lynn said, yes, we get the ARIA charts every week and we dissect all the independent releases out of there, and we publish our charts weekly as well, usually on a Monday evening. We ask that anyone who is an independent artist who's releasing a new song to give us 3 weeks' notice so that we can, because we actively promote new music that the independent sector release. And to do that, just email that information to monica@air.org.au, and she has the wonderful job of scheduling all of that information.
Yeah, brilliant. I think, you know, it's something a lot of us wouldn't think about. You know, I'm putting out a jazz record, I'll make sure I try and get in the ARIA charts. It's just, you know, it seems like it's so pop music orientated, but it's not. There is a jazz ARIA award, there's a jazz chart.
Exactly.
You know, and it's about, you know, getting that information across. Can you touch on the ARIA Awards? How does one get awareness of their record to possibly be nominated for that program?
Yeah, well, I suppose first and foremost, unlike the charts, the ARIA awards are based on entries from ARIA members. So you do need to be an ARIA member to put material forward to be considered by the judging panels. So that is an essential step at the beginning. And I don't know about the ARIA and obviously Maria can speak to that. So we have a range of awards. I think there are about 28 different categories that were presented last week, in fact, in Sydney. So we go through a process at the start of each year of establishing what the criteria will be for each category, what the rules are. Once we have had our first go at that draft, we share it with ARIA members and give them a month to provide feedback and let us know if they think anything needs to be tweaked. Once that's locked down, we approach members in about July and get them to put their entries in. We go through a process of checking the eligibility of the entries. And then on or around September, we have a very large pool of industry folk providing peer assessment and judging those. So we have what we call the ARIA Voting Academy, which covers all of these sort of main award categories. And we also have some specialist judging schools who have particular expertise in different areas. For example, the engineering award or the mastering award, cover art, or some of the genres like country or jazz or classical. And then nominations are announced in October and winners are announced as they were last week in November.
Oh, Dave was trying to do a hold.
Did you want to talk to the AIR Awards, Maria?
Yeah, the AIR Awards are run pretty similar. You have to be an AIR member to nominate your release. The definition of independent, simple. As long as you own your master, at least 50% of your master, you're considered independent. You can distribute through a major. Now, in Australia, there's three majors, Sony, Universal and Warner. So you can distribute through one of those, you can distribute through Ditto, you can just use Bandcamp, you can use whatever you like, but as long as you have ownership. So you might look at the AIR Awards in past years and think, Tone's nice, isn't she signed to Sony? She actually owns her own masters. She's independent and she just releases through Sony. And then once all those nominations are in, we open up voting, and voting is via members as well as specialist categories, like for the jazz category, the classical, dance categories, and also a general voting pool. And we usually hold our events, well, we have for the last 5 years, in Adelaide in August, as well, in conjunction with our IndieCon Australia conference.
Thanks, Maria. Paul, it's great to have you back. I wanted to say it's been really brilliant to see Musicians Australia campaign for minimum live performance fees. Do you want to talk a little bit about that campaign?
Sure, thanks for the opportunity. One of the things we learnt when we started this thing, members started organising, was that the proportion of their incomes from recorded music were very low. In fact, it's a much smaller proportion of their total incomes than come from, you know, performance or other jobs or whatever, teaching. So our focus has been on performance. And of course, there are very few musicians who can rely on who have a reliable income as a performer. Those who are in our orchestras, and we represent all of those people, are very lucky to have that income stream as employees, but most musicians don't have anything like that. So our focus has been on two things: our call to our members, demand to be paid, and don't undercut. It's a very simple message, and it goes to the fact that the performance sector for most musicians has no real regulation to ensure that there are any minimum fees payable. In fact, a quarter of gigs are unpaid according to our surveys, and then people often accept gigs for less than what it's worth for them to do it. Right? It's a very clear case of exploitation, and of those who are really the most essential part of the live performance industry actually bearing all of the risk and taking all the pain. Now, of course, there are musicians who can command a fee and will, but most don't, unfortunately. So the minimum fee campaign is also leveraging a really basic and, I don't think, a kind of indisputable public policy rule, which is when governments spend our money, it should be spent in a way that's ethical, that supports people, and it shouldn't play into exploitation. And of course, if you're a musician, or rather, if you're a worker in a bar or venue, behind the bar, pouring a beer or whatever, and there's an event that's being funded partially or substantially or whatever by COVID relief funding, of course, that's what's happening now. So what will be happening into the future, you can get a minimum fee from that. I mean, you have to get paid your basic award rate. If you're in the corner of that same venue behind a microphone with a guitar, you can get nothing. And unfortunately, we have hundreds of examples where that's occurred. Now, we know the commercial pressures at play, but we also have to do our job on behalf of our members and demand that there's some fairness and equity, at least, or at least initially, where there's public money being used. I think I can't imagine any fair-minded person would be able to object to that. So far, I mean, in what other industry would you see public money being spent and actually at the end of the chain of that spending, you see musicians or any worker getting nothing, right, or being encouraged to undercut just to get the gig. That's not a fair outcome. So we've been lucky that, well, not lucky, I think our work has compelled governments to see the sense of that in South Australia, not Victoria, WA, Queensland, and last week in the New South Wales Parliament, the upper house passed a resolution in support of this. It's unfortunate, and you know, we know that we'll get a good result out of New South Wales. It's unfortunate that the Victorian minister and the government at large have not chosen to apply this simple rule that applies for everybody else. It's, you know, Melbourne claims to be the live music capital of the world, doesn't it? But yet it's unable to properly reward its musicians in a way that's socially acceptable. So we'll continue to work on this, of course. There's no other reason for us to be here other than to continue to try and get equity and fairness for our members. So it's a continuing campaign. We invite all in this auditorium and all online to join us in this campaign. It's essential for the industry. It's essential that we make this industry, particularly the performance side of it, fair for musicians, because they're the ones who have suffered so much through COVID. That's simply highlighted and exacerbated a structural problem that was pre-existing COVID. And we should take this opportunity to rebuild the industry on the basis of fairness and equity for musicians. Thanks for hearing me out on my rave.
Yeah, no, I really support that. And thank you for fighting the good fight. It's really hard for a lot of musicians to feel confident in having conversations like this because, you know, it's a really tough industry already, and the sense of value and sense of worth and being in a market value system and trying to put a price on our art is really complicated. But it's not just venues that employ us. It's often our fellow musicians that are really the ones booking and employing us. So, you know, in a lot of cases, especially with instrumentalists, you know, you might never be the person that is in touch with the venue. You're only ever booked for shows by other bandmates. So do you have any advice, Paul, in terms of best practice for how artists can engage each other for shows, treating each other in an ethical way, including any tips or points you might have around superannuation? Because my understanding is that whenever you're a sole trader who is invoicing for more than $450 within a calendar month, you're entitled to super. So if you're in a band and you're doing three shows a month and you are getting that $250 minimum for those three gigs, you are actually entitled to a super. But I know in a lot of cases, the venues aren't paying it, the festivals aren't paying it, and certainly band members aren't paying each other super. So what are some tips or strategies we can use when we're employing each other as artists?
Okay. Well, look, the reason why we're focusing on a minimum fee is because without a minimum, that your total fee, even if you are legally entitled to superannuation, could be discounted by whatever that superannuation is. I mean, that could come off the top unless there's a minimum that enforces some standard which you can then top up with the super requirement. So the minimum is absolutely essential in order to actually provide stability and to allow other statutory entitlements such as superannuation to flow as they are intended to flow to all workers, including musicians. So the minimum fee is essential. The way we will get that is by people working together to demand it and putting it in their fees. And I'm pleased to report that we've got hundreds and thousands of people now with us, and we hope that'll work. If you're working with other musicians as an employee and you've got a very clear entitlement to it, then of course you've got to, you know, there's an industrial right there you can enforce. But, you know, let's be realistic. Are you going to enforce an industrial right on your mates for a fee which they can't command in the market because the market doesn't satisfy it? You're probably not going to do that, right? You probably want the gig. You probably want to continue to work with them. I mean, if you're doing a session, okay, and you don't know them, and of course many of our members are lucky to be in that position, and they will. That's a more straight transaction, and that's not so much of a problem. You know, those members of ours do get paid, but if you're in a more collegiate, collaborative process with your mates, and you are in an employment relationship, what we say is work together to ensure that the overall fee supports all of you in the way that it should, and start with the minimum. If you're really in demand, you can put your premium on top of that minimum, and many of our members are also able to do that. So not an easy question, although if you boil it down to the principles, I think it does become easier.
Yeah, thank you for that. I guess the Melbourne point is really an interesting one compared to some other places around Australia. I know, you know, I used to live in Brisbane, I've lived in other cities around Australia, and I have found that in some other parts of the country, paying bands a guaranteed fee is pretty common, whereas in Melbourne, a lot of the venues are door deal shows, so there isn't conversations about minimums, and it's hard to guarantee your bandmates any kind of fee because it's all just a kind of risk basis. And if you are guaranteeing your bandmates a fee, then you as the band leader or singer in that case is putting their own personal money on the line and might be going into debt to promote shows. Paul, are you suggesting that, you know, as artists we should be negotiating with venues to do more hybrid model gigs? So, you know, I'm a bit of a fan of, say we did look at that guarantee versus door split type gig, that we should negotiate and say we believe, you know, we should be charging you the minimum fee, so how about you pay our quartet $1,000 or, you know, a 60-40 split of the door, whichever is greater, you know, because the artists are the ones that have the negotiating power in this situation. Do you agree? Is that a model we should be pushing for?
Well, look, I think it's a bit early for us to say what a desirable model is, or if indeed there is one desirable model. You know, one of the things we're working on, and I have to say and acknowledge that Music Victoria, for instance, is a great organisation with whom we who have supported our minimum fee, for instance. So that relationship with that organisation, and there are certainly other organisations we'd like to work with, will allow us to do kind of the hard work about what are the business models, right? What are the performance business models in this sector, and what's the kind of map of them? At one end, We might have purely exploitative models, if you like. Somewhere in the middle and towards the other end, we'll have models of for performance that are much more supportive and able to support musicians because of the natural kind of models, the natural economics of, that, of those models. We want to work on that basis. We want to get to the stage, and as I said with Music Victoria, where we have a negotiation or a discussion, to put it more plainly, about what the industry should look like. And we've always talked about having an industry code of conduct, right, which would be based on a minimum guarantee for musicians, but it might have other obligations which musicians would sign up to as part of being in Musicians Australia as well. So hard to forecast exactly what all of the detail of such a code would look like, but I think people understand that such an arrangement would be a beneficial platform for all of us. It would allow the industry to be more stable for musicians. We invite industry, business to talk to us about what they need, and on the basis of that conversation, we can establish something that will be beneficial for everybody. So rather than models, I think we're looking at a relationship which can establish a sound industry going forward.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. And I think that's something, you know, to have in mind as well with our careers as artists. You know, we do a range of activities, whether that be doing arrangements for people, teaching, lecturing, putting out records, live shows. The live show component, you know, can be a larger part of your income than recordings. That can shift and change throughout your career. So you want to have all of those bases covered so that you are remunerated for the work that you do. We've got a couple of minutes before we wrap this particular panel. Did anybody have any questions? Yes.
Mm-hmm. They make their changes, they jazz it up, however they do, and then they send it back to you, and then you're the one to release it because you're releasing a remix EP or album of your previous work. So how would you go about, like, making sure that the splits are even in that situation? Because really they're not changing the composition that much, it's quite set. So therefore, that's not going to change, but you'll be then negotiating the master.
Yes. Lynn, did you hear that question? You did? Yeah, great. We're just talking about remixes and the rights around them. Do you want to answer that, Cam?
Yeah, sure. You're absolutely right. So in terms of the composition itself, from an APRA perspective, it doesn't change unless you tell us otherwise. So as a general rule, you don't even need to submit an additional registration. If we see track and then track remix, we're going to assume the remix is exactly the same as the track from a compositional standpoint, unless you say otherwise. And there are a handful of examples where we will have particular registrations where a remix has added additional content, but they're rare. So a lot of that's going to come down to your contracts and agreements around the actual master and the sound recording itself. But yeah, from an APRA standpoint, yeah, you're 100% on the money.
Yeah, I mean, unless they added something really significant, it's the same song, just a slightly different version of it.
And I'd point out as well, that's your call to make as well, actually. Like, as the copyright owner of the original, it's actually you are the person that has to actually say to us that, oh, actually. And this goes for arrangements as well. Like, arrangements are even more rare than remixes, I would argue, in terms of right splits. But the original copyright owner is the person that makes that call. It's not, you know, anyone else. So
it's quite interesting, especially if you're paying someone to make a remix of your music, then in most cases, going back to what you were saying about don't trust the, you know, the legal norm, but you would own that entire work.
Put it into the contract then.
Yeah. Yeah, if you're commissioning, then yeah, you own
it. You make it clear.
Yeah.
Because otherwise sometimes producers can argue, can request a producer split. Lynn, have you come across that a lot?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it goes back to the conversation we've been having consistently through the session today. be very, very clear about what you contract someone to do, what the arrangements are, you know, what the relationship is between you, because in that instance, you know, CAM covered what happens in terms of the composition, but you're right, who owns the reporting? And certainly at PPCA, people need to register each mix. Each track is different, could have different ownership, and we require each one to be registered with us. And we are definitely interested in the ownership situation for each one. It's critical because for us, fundamentally, it gets back to whether we can even include it in our blanket licence. If it's not owned by someone who has authorised PPCA, we're simply not licensing it for anyone, so there won't be any revenue through us.
I've got time for one more question. Tim?
Thanks, Chelsea. I actually submitted some questions via the slide.
Oh, great. Did you? Oh, fantastic.
I thought I would use the technology available as a big screen.
That's brilliant. Thank you.
Tech.
Yes, please.
Oh,
no, I've got them here. But you go.
Okay. A little bit awkward. It's okay. Probably best directed or answered by Cameron. Is there a register so that composers can ensure festivals and or online streaming concert companies are collecting and submitting set lists appropriately?
Sure. So you can always get in touch with me is probably your best bet. Like, so I take care of like classical jazz sound art for Australia. So if you've got a question, just shoot me an email. It's clam@apra. You're never going to forget that or stop laughing about it. It's great. But as a general rule, so like if you're at the festival and they ask you for a set list, you can be pretty safe that they're submitting it. We will also, like, if there are holes in, like, and like, look, people lose paperwork, people forget to do stuff happens, it's cool. We will go and chase. Like, if we know, okay, we're missing these set lists, okay, where could we go to find them? We will go and forage and dig. In terms of, like, streaming services and online stuff, as a general rule, I'd say, to start with, give it 6 months for domestic earnings. International earnings take a little bit longer because they've got to be processed by our like sister societies overseas and then sent to us and then processed. So that can be up to a year. But if you've had something that's like really notable, like something that's really gotten a lot of play, like you know you've been playlisted on Spotify and something's done like super well, send me an email. I'll flag it. I'll keep an eye on it, and we can kind of you know check in. Especially if you kind of know what audience you're looking at. So say, again, we'll go with the Spotify example because they're easy. You know, this track's done really well over the last 3 months, like really, really well, and I can see the vast majority of my listeners are in the US. Great thing to tell me, because I can then send a query off to the US societies and go, hey, can you just keep an ear out for this because I think this is going to come through. So definitely shoot me an email at any point. Always happy to chase things for you.
We're going to have to wrap it up there. Thank you all so much for joining the Charter Course panel. Please put your hands together for our wonderful panel.
That was Charter Course at Melbourne International Jazz Festival Congress. For more info, find the links to APRA AMCOS, PPCA, AIR and Musicians Australia in the show notes. Please keep in touch with Melbourne International Jazz Festival by subscribing to our e-news at melbournejazz.com. Follow us on social media and subscribe on your preferred platform for more podcast episodes. We would like to thank Principal Partners Creative Victoria and the Australia Council, the Vizard Foundation, the Rise Fund and Australian Government Initiative, the Helen McPherson Smith Trust and the US Consulate.